a veterinarian. Just put yes on there so I can make sure I get you a certificate so you can get some CE credits for today.
Thanks everybody for having us. Happy to be here. And Emily tells me that later on during the week it's supposedly getting up to 15 degrees or something. So that's kind of encouraging. So the talk today, if you guys have questions or comments, you don't have to wait till the end. Just, chime in. It shouldn't be too formal. Some of the stuff's going to be super straightforward. Some of the stuff you guys very well may already be doing. And so hopefully you'll be able to take a couple of ideas and be able to put them into action. So basically, just a bit of background about myself. I was in full-time practice in Toronto for about 25 years. And joined Royal Canin back in October. I always felt really comfortable and proud to recommend Royal Canin diets when I was in full-time practice. Actually just worked this past Saturday, so I still keep my hand in things. But having been on the inside now for a little bit, get a better idea of how things run and work, even more proud, quite frankly, to be recommending Royal Canin diets. So these are some of the four-legged family members that I have. Teva's, I have to change this. She just turned five on the weekend, which is kind of crazy because she still seems like a puppy to me. This is actually in the field behind the Royal Canin offices in Guelph, and Royal Canin has a bring your dog to work policy, so as long as your dog doesn't eat other dogs, it's actually a lot of fun to hang out. This is Marley in the middle, who, as you can tell, helps me choose which slides I put into the presentations. And then this is Maxie. She's an 11-year-old lab mix that has come into my life sort of in the last 6 months. So that's who I tend to hang out with. So just a couple of acknowledgements. Dr. Brenda Griffin, who I've never met, is what's called a board-certified internal medicine specialist who does a lot of work with shelters and specifically the SPCA in the United States. So a lot of this information came from her talks. The ASPCA, and if you haven't had a chance to be on their website, a lot of the slides and photos in my presentation come from there. I found the site to be incredibly user-friendly, straightforward, and simple. And then a colleague of mine, Dr. Anne-Marie Germain, is does the same kind of stuff as me, but is all things urinary. So if I ever have a question that's baffling me, she's the person that I reach out to. But she also, as you'll see towards the end of the presentation, has clicker trained her cats. And they're unbelievable, quite frankly. they're better than humans. And if I hadn't seen it myself, I wouldn't believe that you could clicker train a cat. And actually, if you Google clicker training in cats, I can't believe how many hits you get. Actually, it's really quite cool. And then, as I say, Marley helped me with the presentation as well. So we're not going to do too much in the way of science, but for the purposes of sort of understanding, sometimes when we talk about things like shock or stress, there's the sort of lay terminology and then the actual science side of things. So stress is actually meant, believe it or not, as a good thing in the body short term, which is actually oftentimes the case with different things. So for instance, you'll hear people talk about inflammation and that it's a bad thing. But in actual fact, inflammation is meant to address things that happen in the body short term. It gets to be problematic when it becomes a long-term problem, which is the same thing with stress. So there's this area in the brain sort of down below that's called the hypothalamus. The word hypo in Latin means underneath, so it's towards the bottom of this part of the brain that's called the thalamus. And then this teeny weeny little organ just below the hypothalamus is this thing that's called the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland in vet school for me was actually kind of one of my favoritest glands, because it, believe it or not, secretes like half a dozen different hormones, even though it's teeny weeny. And it's sort of like this command center, because depending on what hormone it sends out, that hormone has like instructions. So it kind of reminds me of like a pigeon, you know, that carries those notes. So basically, depending on what the body needs, it sends out less or more of this half dozen hormones or so. So basically, for our purposes, when it comes to stress, it will send out this hormone that's called ACTH. And that stands for something, but it, you know, no need to go into its detail because it's a really long word. And ACTH basically is a hormone that likes the adrenal gland, which is sort of symbolized by that sort of triangle yellow thing in the bottom of the slide. And so the adrenal gland, does anybody know what the word renal means if you're not a technician?
I think it means it has to do with the kidneys.
That's exactly correct. So it's in French, for those of you that are bilingual, les reins means, or rein is the word for kidney. It's only in English where we call it a word that actually is pointless. So adrenal means on top of the renal organ or kidney. So the adrenal gland is a teeny weeny little gland just on top of the kidney, but much like this teeny weeny pituitary, it actually secretes its own half dozen hormones or so. And one of the hormones that it secretes is cortisol. And so you'll hear people talk about cortisone, or prednisone, or prednisolone. Anything that ends in that zone kind of word is normally just a synthetic or artificial form of cortisol. So the body produces its own stress hormone, which is called cortisol, naturally. And what it's meant to do is respond to a bunch of different stressors in your body. So I'm sure many of you have heard of the flight or fight response. And so that, in essence, is where cortisone is stimulated. So the body gets this message, the brain reacts, it produces that ACTH. The ACTH then tells the adrenal gland to produce cortisone because we've got a stressful situation. And so what happens is your blood pressure rises, your pupils dilate, and you're like, oh my goodness, something dreadful is about to happen. I better react. I better swerve and avoid hitting this car while I'm talking and texting, right? Kind of thing, even though I shouldn't be doing that in the first place, right? So that's the kind of thing where actually your body's doing what it's supposed to be doing. The problem arises when we end up having that cortisol secreted for lengthy periods of time. And bringing it back to stuff that you guys can relate to, this is where it's really problematic in shelters. Because anybody in the room get those cold sores on their lips from time to time? Any idea what virus causes that? Herpes, right? And so we talk about viruses as being species specific. In other words, if you have cold sores, your cat's not going to get those from you, just like you're not going to get upper respiratory infection, even though clients always ask us, you know, I had a cold and now my cat has a cold. Was it me that gave my cat the cold, right? Which, you know, seems kind of logical, especially oftentimes people feel like they gave birth to their cat, right? So you can sort of relate to what they're asking. But as it turns out, one of the features of herpes virus, no matter what the species is it likes to lay dormant. It likes to have a snooze, right? Keeping on the theme of like French or Latin words, right? Dormant means to sleep. And so it stays put for a while until there's a stress. And so one of the things that cortisol is meant to do is decrease inflammation. And remember, I was talking about the fact that inflammation is actually a good thing. Well, the word inflammation actually just means the bringing about of white blood cells to an area, And the white blood cells, if we think of them as like soldiers, they actually are meant to respond to the invasion of the body by either a virus or a bacteria or a fungus, something that doesn't belong. But if we increase cortisone, that makes inflammation go down, which means we have an inability to fight whatever is invading us or already dormant in the body. So in other words, if we have herpes virus that lays dormant and we have a stress all of a sudden, which means we're not able to fight infection, now that allows the herpes virus to start replicating, creating a bit of a party, and then we end up with the one veterinarian that I like to listen to talks about, which is snorking cats, right? And so we've all seen them, runny eyes, runny nose, sneezing. They look kind of pitiful. And then as adults, in my world as a practicing veterinarian, oftentimes, you know, it would wax and wane. So it would go away, and then people would come in with their pet because they didn't understand, they didn't have a new cat that came, you know, home. There was nothing that really changed, but all of a sudden, they caught a cold, right? And they never caught it, they had it the whole time. It's been estimated that around 90 to 95% of cats, carry feline herpes virus.
Just gonna back it up here. I think I hit that because I was talking so much.
So basically, this is a real problem, especially in shelters. Now, I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, depending on your experience, by comparison to 5 to 10 years ago, this has become less of a problem than it was before. And that has a lot to do with the vaccinations that are done, that has a lot to do with the quarantines that are put in place, and it also has a lot to do, we seem to be going backwards all of a sudden,
with the fact that ultimately, things like spot cleaning over completely moving a cat into a different cage will help decrease stress.
Do you guys do spot cleaning here as opposed to moving them from cage to cage? Yeah, that's awesome. I've probably given this talk now at least, between a half a dozen to a dozen shelters, and I'd say upwards of around 90% of the shelters are doing spot cleaning as well. Ultimately, there have been quite a number of studies that have been done, both in cats and in dogs, showing that spot cleaning greatly reduces the amount of stress, especially when it comes to cats, because cats don't like change. Dogs kind of like, well, you know, especially depending on the breed, it's like, hey, what are we doing today? Let's just go with the flow, right? But cats definitely like their environment kept the same as much as possible. And more importantly as well, from a disinfection standpoint, it's been shown that spot cleaning is at least, if not more, beneficial in terms of sanitation. So there's really no downside to it whatsoever. It decreases stress. It allows us to be able to keep their stuff with them, which again is something in cats that they really like. I think it also decreases our stress when we're handling the animals because we feel better. I know when I used to work as a kennel attendant, I would have angst, especially if it was a cat that wanted to take off my head, about moving them from kennel to kennel. This was a study that was done in dogs that showed that the same actually applies to them as well. Obviously a little bit different because they're, depending on the size of the dog, they're going to be in a larger cage or run, but still nonetheless, keeping their environment as consistent as possibly is definitely healthy. And ultimately, there are some things that are very obvious, right? It allows them, both cats and dogs, to be able to urinate and defecate in one area and be able to eat in another. And then from a handling standpoint, you're just not interacting with them as much as you need to directly. For some cats, for some dogs, they want to do that, right? They want to, especially in the case of dogs, they want to interact more. But in the case of cats, right, if they're not the kind of cat that wants to come to you, as they say, if they're the kind of cat that wants to take your head off, right, or is extremely sort of low in terms of any kind of human interaction or close to feral, then being able to minimize the contact that we have with them is definitely a very simple way of being able to reduce their stress level. And then, I'm not sure, I think that you were kind enough to give me a tour last time, and most of the cages are double compartment. And so that's advantageous as well, right? Because we can very easily move them into one of those as we're cleaning out the other space, and by the same token, limit the amount of interaction that we have with them and therefore decrease their stress. And if any of you guys want to take a photo of that, these are just a couple of different little protocols around spot cleaning, but it sounds like that's what you guys are already doing, so that's wonderful.
And Ellie, maybe you can make that slide available to me, and then I can share it with Doug and Marshall, and share with everyone.
Wait for it.
Yeah.
All right. So some more subtle kinds of things that we can do is ultimately be aware of the fact that we want, I know when I go in to examine a cat that's been hospitalized, the first thing that I do is stand back and just observe them. And it allows me to do a couple of things. Is one, you know, I can check out their food bowl, I can check out their litter depending on how close I am, without having to, you know, open up the cage or be so close to them that I'm going to be intimidating. As a veterinarian, it also allows me to count their breathing rate, because as soon as you get closer and closer to a cat, you'll notice that their breathing rate goes up and up and up, because now they're getting a little bit more stressed, and so you have an erroneous high reading. So there are certain things that we can do before we actually come in contact with them or need to open up the cage door. And the amount of time that we can limit that contact, unless, again, they're wanting to have contact with us, really helps to reduce the stress and allows us to be able to recognize, what does this cat need? Again, if we're at the extremes, a cat that's rubbing up against the cage door because they're purring up a storm and super affectionate, that's not difficult for us to assess. A cat that wants to take our head off is not difficult for us to assess either. Even before we get close, if we listen carefully, we're going to hear that under their breath growl, that they're gearing up to let us know that they'd really rather not have any contact with us whatsoever. But it's more the cats that are just a little bit more subtle about their demeanor that stepping back and just observing for 5 to 10 seconds, we're not talking about lengthy periods of time, allows us to be able to know what we're about to get into. And then ultimately, looking for certain signs of what we call fear, anxiety, and stress. So are their pupils completely dilated? Do they have those little slit eyes that look completely different than that, and we can actually see the color of their pupils, which means that they're more relaxed under the circumstances. And none of this is, again, rocket science, but it allows us to be able to pick up on things. And sometimes, and I know I'm guilty of this as well, we know we have a bunch of intakes, maybe there's a couple of surgeries going on that day, so there's a bunch of things going on and we just want to get through things. But the cat has no idea that we have a busy day. And so taking that 5 to 10 seconds can sometimes really make things just a little bit less stressful. So these are obviously some of the things that we're going to see. In the case of the upper left-hand corner, we can see a cat that seems to be pretty chill about things. Same thing in the bottom left. And clearly the two cats on the right, the upper right-hand corner, that cat looks to be quite fearful. And we would rather not have any interaction with the bottom right cat if we can avoid it. And you don't have to work in a shelter for a long period of time to pick up on that one. So, I don't know if any of you guys are familiar with the Fear Free Pets movement. One does not need to be a veterinarian or a technician in order to register for that. It's not inexpensive. I believe it's around $250 US. There are 8 modules. And then at the end of the module, each of the modules, there's a test. And at the end of the whole process, you actually become what's called fear-free certified. And in the veterinary practice world, this has caught on a tremendous amount of sort of momentum because of the fact that it's a way of differentiating yourself as being a little bit more attentive, a little bit more patient, and understanding when an animal that comes in that's quite aggressive. So just anecdotally, I worked on Saturday. This was a dog. There was a note on the file that the dog, quote unquote, could be aggressive. This dog, the last time that it came in, was dispensed a specific type of sedative that's called trazodone. But unfortunately, the owner was in a hurry and didn't give it 2 hours before. He popped it in about a half hour before. He wanted to give less of the medication, even though it's really safe. And the only thing that I was able to do is have the owner put a muzzle on this dog and me stick a needle in it for its back seat, because it was so frightened and definitely, you know, would have bit me had it had the occasion to do so, because it was so fearful. That's not an ideal situation. And same kind of thing, you know, when we're talking about a shelter situation, there's going to be situations where you've got to get done what you've got to get done. But by the same token, I'm sure you guys have seen it as well, where you have a cat that first comes in at intake, you know, it's ready to jump through the false ceiling kind of thing. And then by day 3, 4, or 5, if it's seeing the same people and ultimately they're taking a little bit of time, that cat almost becomes, you know, a completely different individual. And you know, that's where we really feel like we're making a difference.
Alan, can I just add a quick thing to that too? Watson Veterinary Hospital in Waterdown, I did a tour with our vet team, and they are actually certified in the fear-free pet for the vet clinics, and they're super proud to talk about it. So if you live near Waterdown or you're driving by, you can pop in and to see some of the things that they did, even right when you walk in, to see how some of these things work in action.
That sounds like a great idea. Just to give you an idea of like what is involved. So they break down things into 8 modules, to the degree where they start module 1, where what can the owner do before they actually come into the clinic for their appointment. And then module 2 will be when they're in the reception area before they go into the exam room. What are some of the things that they can do and what the clinic can do for them. Then once they're in the exam room. So it really breaks it down step by step. So by analogy, right, what are some of the things that you guys can do when you're looking at intakes? If you've got a cat that clearly does not have much in the way of history of interacting with humans, you're gonna have a limited number of things that you're gonna be able to do, right? You're gonna have a situation whereby, you know, that cat needs to get in, get done what needs to get done, and then give that cat some quiet time. Because limiting the number of things that's done to that individual is probably what's most important.
I think my slide thing is going on a journey of its own. So I'm just gonna back this up one. There we go.
So, you know, again, subtle things, but what can we look for? As we said earlier, this cat is clearly a cat that is scared, right? Does it look like a cat who's necessarily going to lunge at you? I saw someone shaking their head. I agree. I don't think so either, right? But taking a moment to be able to assess this guy, to know that, okay, this is a guy who definitely we want to do spot cleaning and minimum interaction at the beginning, and let him get comfortable with us, and then based on how he interacts with us, we can approach him more, right? But to reach into this guy's cage is probably not going to help us. the advantage of this guy is we can set his food and his water down and clean his cage quite easily because he's so far back inside his cage. But our inclination perhaps, or depending on how much experience, let's say somebody who volunteers has, it would be important to coach that volunteer to let them know this is probably not a guy that you want to like try and hug because that's not gonna help, right? But again, you know, yes, for sure, that's a funny thing to hear, but for someone who hasn't got a whole lot of experience and really wants to help, it might be their inclination to, you know, if you take the 2 or 3 year old analogy where they're running around and they want to hug everything, you know, I remember that my son and daughter who are 20 and 23 now, they didn't learn mom or dad as their first words. They learned the word gentle. You know, and we didn't plan it that way, but we just kept on saying it around our dogs and cats. So, and then, of course, you know, if we're dealing with a cat that is a hider, then they're giving us the opportunity to be able to allow them to adjust to us, as opposed to us trying to seek them. So I'm not sure if you can see this, but this guy right over here is Marley. Okay, and that's at the clinic where I work, which is actually where I adopted Marley from. Right? And Marley is one of the most sweet cats I've ever met in my life. And I, you know, practiced for 25 years. I probably met, 20 to 30,000 cats, something like that, I'm guessing. Right? I wake up in the morning and occasionally he's purring and lying on my back. Right? So he's like that affectionate. But put him into an environment where, you know, he's got a nice comfy fleece and he's got some water at the front and his litter box and a place to perch, but he's chosen to hide in the very back of his cage. This is a guy who's incredibly socially adjusted, purrs almost on command, right? But he's still petrified. And all that's being done to him, just so you know, is that I bring him in occasionally because I'm a horrendous groomer and he's a long-haired cat and he mats from time to time. Right? So I've got to shave out those mats because it's just not fair to him to try to brush through those things. And he's not making an association with that because we use the electric clippers, so there's no pain associated with it whatsoever. But it's a new environment, right? New people, new smells. Right? And so it's like, if you will, we got to think like a cat. Right? By the time the morning wore on, he was more curious, more interactive. And that's a well-adjusted social guy, right? So just imagine what the cats that come into a lot of the shelters are feeling like, because, you know, they, who knows where they've been. Any questions? Yeah?
Oh, sorry.
It's
okay.
Thank you. I'm sorry. I thought it was like a personal question.
Whisper it.
All right. So feigning sleep. I actually didn't know what feigning means, quite frankly. But this is feigning sleep, right? So sometimes people can mistake in this for, you know, pretty relaxed, pretty comfortable. But this guy's actually on guard, right? You know how people say, I'm going to take a cat nap, mm-hmm. right? How refreshed you feel when you take a cat nap? Not. Somebody said
very.
I actually feel ripped off. So it, more than anything, it's just they're not in a relaxed state, right? They're on guard. And so again, it's not that we shouldn't interact with this guy, but we have to appreciate the fact that he's not at ease, right? No. Is there anything we can do? Yes. Be patient. Spot cleaning. Be very gentle and quiet about when we put, you know, his food and water in. Be consistent about when the food and water comes in. If he's got to be medicated, the medication should be administered as much as possible at consistent times of the day, so that, as we will see in a moment, it's been shown that even if we need to do something stressful to a cat or a dog, or for that matter, a person, right? It's the reason why in hospitals people get their medications at the same time, because they know it's coming. But then they know that they also have some downtime and they can breathe a sigh of relief afterwards. Life will not end. kind of thing. So, obviously, this is the ideal. It doesn't happen too often, let alone the fact that most of the time in shelters, obviously, we're not housing animals together, unless we're talking about group housing rooms, which are definitely ideal, but as you know, that's not everyone that can be in that kind of situation. But basically, it's cats acting like cats. And, you know, we've all seen it. They're eating well, they're playing, they're stretching, they're grooming. Not every cat purrs, but a lot of them do. And you know, I've had people say this as well in the exam room. Unfortunately, cats will also purr when they're deathly ill. And so you can't always use that as a means of being able to assume. But, you know, if they're doing all these other things, they're eating well, they're interacting, they're coming to the front of the cage, they're, even before you open the door, they're doing the, you know, brushing of their head up against the cage door, then you can presume that that purring is because they're super happy. And purring is a really difficult thing to study because as soon as you start studying it, they stop. But it's a fair assessment that most of the time it means that they're content. So, I found out actually that Dr. Gurko worked at one of the humane societies that we visited in Abbotsford just a couple of weeks ago. I had no idea she was A, Canadian, B, a woman, so I took a guess and called her a woman during my presentation. That's just because most veterinary classes these days are somewhere between 70-90% women. And then three, she actually did her research at the Humane Society in Abbotsford. So she came up with this really neat thing called the UQ Cat Emotion Index. And then she divides things into contentment behavior. So again, like we talked about cats being cats. Anxiety behaviors, and then frustration behaviors. And you know, you can read these and they're pretty straightforward, but what I draw your attention to more than anything is it's those anxiety behaviors that we need to proactively watch for. They're not things that, you know, startle, freeze, staying away from humans. Those are, if you will, very subtle behaviors. They're not things that are going to hit us in the head. And so that's where take 5 to 10 seconds, observe the individual that you're about to deal with, and make an assessment. So just being a little bit more mindful, a little bit more present before we go ahead and do what we're about to do is a simple way of being able to reduce the stress on that individual. And then, again, through her studies, she showed that we can improve their emotional well-being if we think like a cat for a moment. And, you know, what does that mean? Well, that means that they don't want a hug. They don't want to necessarily be pulled towards us. Right? We need to be patient as much as is feasible during the course of our day. And that to remember that in actual fact, as we saw at the outset of the talk, that the less stress a cat feels, the less their immune system is suppressed, and the less they will manifest things as simple as upper respiratory infection. And she actually showed this in her research. So as it turns out, I used to work for SIBA, but that's not why this feel away diffuser is up. I think I saw through the clinic that you guys use feel away, which is great. I said clinic, I meant shelter, sorry. And ultimately, all of these things help. And we know that for those of you that aren't familiar, feel away is a synthetic form of what's called a pheromone. And a pheromone is not a hormone. It is what's called a chemical receptor. So it's some cats and dogs have this organ inside their sort of mouth-ish area that's called a vomeronasal organ. If they're out under anesthesia, you can actually see where it is. If not, it's kind of hard to find. It doesn't really matter. But essentially, When cats are interacting with one another, you'll notice that they very deliberately sort of sniff things, right? And so that's actually their way of being able to appreciate the scent that's present. And so fear has a pheromone associated with it. Anger has a pheromone associated with it. These are all things that cats and dogs, much more so than us, can pick up. And so, for instance, in the clinic, I'll actually spray myself before appointments with Feel Away. It's not something that has any kind of odor whatsoever. And occasionally, I would forget to do that, and I would try to, you know, understand why I'm having such a stressful afternoon, right? That I just seem to have a bunch of cats that are really ticked off of me. Right? And it's not magic, but it just brings their stress level down a teeny bit. So it's something that, you know, it's really, really easy to be able to implement. And again, speaks to the subtlety of things that we can do that make a big impact. So the place to start is an intake, right? So do we have a cat that's already showing social comfort? In which case, you know, we can do things that maybe we don't have to do right away later. So as an example, you know, vaccinating that individual, maybe, you know, we can at the same time do a full physical exam on that individual without stressing them out, versus do we have an individual who clearly is not used to human interaction, and the more we can limit our interaction with them, the better. Well, that's the individual that, yes, you want to conduct that physical and vaccination and whatever else that needs to be done with that individual right from the get-go, and then allow them their time on their own afterwards. So again, it all starts at intake for sure. Some of the things that I've seen at most shelters, and we're guilty of this in veterinary hospitals, sometimes we don't do this, is always making sure that we place their carrier on an elevated level, whether that be a table, you know, ideally once they're out of their carrier, a perch of some kind, because it's not normal for a cat to be down and be, if you will, prey to their predators. But sometimes, for instance, when I'm bringing an animal back from the exam room to the treatment area, it might be the kind of thing where everybody has their hands full, and so I'm like, okay, well, you know, so-and-so needs this, I'm just going to set him down on the ground, which would be a real silly thing for me to do, because who knows, there might be another dog that's getting its nails clipped, and that's the first thing that he sees. And again, I'm dealing with an animal under those circumstances that's supposed to be socialized. I can tell you that Marley wouldn't have been real happy with me doing something like that. So something as simple as being mindful of the fact that, you know, if we're going to place a carrier down, it should always be on a table or on some kind of an elevated area. And then, go ahead.
In some of our cages, we have a little shelf unit so that the animals can hide underneath or perch on top. And we've been finding that a lot of those little shelf units have been being taken out of the cages. So it's a good thing to put them back in the cages and ensure that as many cages as possible have those little shelves.
100%. And you know, I'll bring, you know, Marley's photo back. That's exactly, I'm guessing, what you're kind of talking about, right? And those things are not terribly expensive. And they give the cat two options. One is hide underneath, or two, if they're more comfortable, perch on top, right? And very, very simple. But yeah, I think they're critical for cats. They make a huge, huge difference. Because it gives them options.
Would it have the same impact if your cages are stacked above each other, the one on the lower on the ground? Would that be different?
I think, great question. I think ultimately, again, in a sort of enclosed room where there's not a lot of noises, scents, I think it's less critical, right? Unless, of course, you've got cages that are opposite that. Then that becomes much more stressful no matter what height they're at.
Okay.
But I haven't seen that too often where people have facing cages any longer. Is there another question back there? So this was actually, as I was putting the talk together, something that one of our other reps, Perry McLean, sent me. And it's actually a study that was done that shows the impact of a cardboard box on cats. And if any of you have ordered stuff from Amazon and you are not sure whether you're going to give it back, you know that your cat has decided that you can give this thing back, but you're not getting the cardboard box back, right? And it's fascinating. It's this small little device, in quotation marks, the cost is zero, right? From a sanitation standpoint, if it gets kind of decrepit, you recycle it, right? So I can't think of something more available in a shelter, because most of the canned food that we order comes, you know, equipped with a cardboard box. Obviously most of them are not going to be sitting like this, right? But nonetheless, it's a place to hide. It's potentially a place to perch. It can actually be a toy, depending on what they end up doing with it. My Marley chases oftentimes a small little cardboard box all over, you know, my place, which, like, I don't understand, but he thinks it's a blast. So really very readily available, and again, not expensive. And not ingenuitive. This is pretty simple stuff. And so, again, things that we can do is appreciate whether or not the cat is displaying any signs of stress. And so they'll actively look for them. And this UQ Cat Emotion Index is on the ASPCA website. Again, I'll make this slide along with a couple of other ones available to Emily, so that if you guys want them, you can get them. If you've got your phone, you want to take a picture. If you go to the ASPCA website, as I say, it's very user-friendly, very easy to navigate, and all this stuff is actually there. So what are some of the body postures we're looking for, right? Obviously, these guys are pretty happy. We've got our friendly volunteer here who's slowly approaching in a non-threatening way. I'm sure you guys all have these volunteer shirts that you wear to make them more comfortable. But this is exactly what you're talking about, Doug, where you've got a perch, an opportunity for a cat to be able to, be comfortable and get up there. That tells us a message, though. You know, if the cat's not hiding underneath but is actually perched up there, then they're already more comfortable. A cat that's fearful, that's stressful, or that's stressed, rather, is not going to perch themselves up high. Is this cat smiling? Not so much, right? And again, very easy for us to be able to appreciate that, but for someone who's maybe on their first week on volunteering, they might not know that. They might only work with dogs. They'll find out real quickly. But much better for them to get a heads up. And in actual fact, this is one of the most, this and cats on their back are in fact one of the most aggressive positions that they can assume. So not this kind of bunting, but not this kind of bunting. Obviously, that's a cat that's presenting themselves because they're in complete comfort and they're actually seeking human contact. Right? And that's what Marley does under most circumstances. But again, put him into the right situation and he immediately becomes a quote-unquote scary cat. Is this guy aggressive?
No,
right? So it's not always that every cat that, in fact, I keep harping on Marley, but I call Marley a cat dog. He greets me at the door when I get home. He actually rolls over on his back to have his tummy rub, which is typically a death threat for most cats, right? There are definitely situations where you're going to have a cat that's pretty comfortable on its back, right? But for the most part, belly rubs are off limits when it comes to cats. So Dr. Karen Overall is what's called a board-certified veterinary behavioralist, which means that over and above the degree that I have, She did what's called a one-year rotating internship, and then a three-year residency in animal behavior, and then sat an examination that typically specialists will take off somewhere around 2 to 4 months in order to be able to pass. She's probably one of the, she didn't like me saying this, oldest behavioralist in North America, but she lectures to veterinarians all over the world. And so she's taken the time to create a number of veterinary behavior textbooks, but also a lot of wonderful, less technical articles and videos. And this through what's called the Veterinary News .dbm 360 has some wonderful, very simple stuff that you can use to implement pretty quickly. She, if you ever have occasion to listen to her talk, she's amazing. She's a big proponent of quote unquote drugs all around, both for animals and for people. So again, sort of summarizing, anything that we can do that is, you know, realizing that, you know, people can only work so many hours a day, but between the volunteer shifts, the staff shifts, to keep things as consistent as possible, so that a cat that is seeing the same 3 or 4 individuals over the course of the week at set times is going to be more at ease. If they need to be medicated, they know when the pleasant time is versus the non-pleasant time. That non-pleasant time is consistent, it's done for a very short period of time, and we're not talking about like torture chambers, we're talking about administration of a medication, right? Changing of a bandage, something like that. If they know that they then will be okay afterwards, they're less likely to get riled up. And then ultimately, it's about them making sure that they have, if you will, the option to be able to hide, to be able to perch, simple stuff like that. And then something that, quite frankly, the way of this talk, I sort of reminded myself of is that even though I live close by here, I'm fortunate enough to be able to travel around the country and give some of these talks. And so sometimes I'm away for a week at a time, and you know, I get someone to come in, obviously, and look after Marley, which is great, but they don't stay there, right? And so putting our lights on a timer, making sure whoever it is that comes in, make sure that during the daytime, aside from normal light, that a light doesn't stay on 24 hours. Same kind of thing in the shelter. Ideally, at night, the lights should go off. Ideally, in the morning, the light should come on, you know, again, not at exactly the same time, but somewhat the same time. And so the consistency, the predictability of what we're doing is going to make that cat or cats more comfortable. And these, again, we're not talking rocket science type stuff. If we do need to move them, then ideally we give them the option of being able to put their head sort of in the nook of our arm. Making sure that we do it within a towel. Every now and again, we'll have an owner that brings in a cat for an appointment, and they're holding the cat like out here, right? And needless to say, when that cat comes in, it's beside itself, right? No matter how comfortable it is at home. And people will always say to me, you know, oh, I'm really, really sorry, they're not like this at home. Well, of course they're not, right? Like, it's totally not the environment that they're used to. And cats, oftentimes, if you give them the option, they'll take off, but we're not giving them that option. So we have to give them some options within the confinement that we have to have the attitude of, if I can't see you, that means you can't see me, right? And even, in my practice world of having a cat on the exam room table, if I give them a towel and they go up into the little cat scale that we use, just being in the cat scale with the little edges that a baby scale has, it's amazing how much more comfortable they are there. And so I conduct my physical exam while they're on the scale. Right? There's, I mean, one of the adages in veterinary medicine is where do you do a physical exam in a cat? Wherever they tell you, right? Kind of thing. And it does, it helps, same kind of thing. Where do you administer, you know, a medication to the cat, right? If you can, do it inside their cage. Don't get them out, right? Because that's going to definitely increase the stress level. Sometimes you can't help it, right? Like, you just can't, you know, get a hold of them enough in order to be able to do something. So, again, real simple stuff. I had no idea you could blinker train a cat. But from the different videos that I watched to prepare for this presentation, they actually almost respond better than dogs. And ultimately, the best enrichment that we can give them is getting out of the shelter. Right? Not that it's a bad place, but that's obviously not the long-term goal. And the more adjusted they are, the more likely, you guys know better than I do, they're going to leave the shelter. So these are Anne-Marie's cats. She's clicker trained them to get on these two platforms first thing in the morning. So they actually get weighed every morning. I'm not expecting you guys to do this with shelter cats, but it gives you an idea of what you can actually do clicker-wise. My first little project with Marley over the last 3 weeks is, embarrassingly, I have a fat cat. I'm very happy to say, has lost about a half a pound in the last 2 weeks. And that's because one of our other adages that came in is hashtag ban the cup. We're trying to encourage people to actually weigh the food that they feed cats. And so I've started weighing Marley's dry and canned food, and it's making an enormous difference. I'm digressing for a moment, but just as a simple example, 3/4 of a cup of cat food can be anywhere from 48 to 55 grams. And so if you do 7 grams times 7 days, that's 50 grams. That's a whole nother meal a week that you could potentially be feeding your cat. Multiply that times 50 weeks a year, right? And you've got a lot of extra food. And then, you know, if we're being a little on the cheap side for a moment, think about the added costs that we're actually giving ourselves unnecessarily. We're actually causing our cat or cats more harm by overfeeding them as opposed to weighing their food. So she's got them clicker trained to do that. She's got them clicker trained to do things like this. She doesn't have a dog of her own, but niece of hers came by and knew that she's a vet, and all of a sudden decided that she was going to plant her dog with her for roughly about 6 weeks. So she was bringing, I think his name was Sergeant, into the office. Really super sweet. I don't know if you know what a Mastiff looks like. So like a 120-pound dog. Needless to say, Benjamin, and I can't remember the other. Thank you, Eddie. We're not elated with that idea, but she told me, and obviously she doesn't have a picture here, that as soon as she clicker trained the cats, the dogs started doing the same things as the cats, and even though the cats were hissing and spitting at the dog at the time of the clicker training, they would still do exactly what they did like that. So again, you know, it's the routine, it's the predictability, it's the safety factor. Ultimately, again, not stuff that you guys are going to do, but it just gives you an idea of us getting ourselves out of our head in terms of what actually can happen. Because I'm sure you guys can think of, you know, a couple of cats in the shelter right now, right, that would totally go for something like this. And I'm going to start Marley on kick-clicker-train because I totally think he'll be into it for sure. So one of the other websites that I came across that you might be familiar with is this Maddie's Fund. It's got some awesome little videos, really straightforward, very practical, help on stress reduction as well. And then finally, this is the Berkeley Humane Shelter in California, and I just came across this while I was putting the slide deck together, and they actually have this thing called the post-adoption program, which doesn't sound like it's that frequent for people to do. I realize there's a, you know, a staff component, but for those volunteers that you guys know are like, you know, we had co-op students at the vet clinic where we'd know in the first, you know, day or two if these were people that we could actually give more responsibility to because they were, you know, 11 out of 10s. And then we, you know, also had the people that were 6 out of 10, and you know, the cleaning was what they wanted to do, right? And that's cool. The world's made up of all kinds of different people. But for those people that are really keen, stress doesn't end within the shelter, right? The stress also happens. I mean, fortunately, most shelters, it's been estimated, have somewhere around a 5% return rate. But, you know, if we can cut that in half to 2.5%, then one of the things that we can do is equip a client or an adopter before they go home with some information like some of the websites that I've shared and will share with you guys. But at the same time, checking in with them, finding out what's going on. Have they all of a sudden decided that they're going to switch foods upon arrival home and give that cat diarrhea and then back they cough? So just a little thought that I thought was kind of a neat thing to be able to do if it's feasible. That's it. Any questions?
So it's one of your slides who said group housing whenever possible, and it's not something you really talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I've sort of wondered about.
Yep.
Great in the sense, because a lot of our cats, when they come here, they're not here that long, and I know cats should be introduced to each other slowly. Some cats, you know, by species, cats are not a gregarious animal.
Agreed. They've been shown to be definitely
the opposite.
Yeah.
Right? So I guess I'm wondering about the pros and cons and how to implement a group housing system briefly.
For sure. So, you guys have a group
housing?
We don't
do any group housing, no.
And any particular reason?
I mean, I've been here forever, but
sometimes it's a matter of space.
Sometimes it's a matter of sanitation. Sometimes it's a matter of preventing injury and disease.
So the sanitation, I don't want to say it's not an issue, but if people are doing things sanitation-wise, generally, then it's been shown that that's really not much of a concern, as long as, you know, that animal's not displaying any signs of an upper respiratory infection. Ideally the animal's been feline leukemia and immunodeficiency virus tested, that kind of stuff, which in my experience in the shelters that I've been in that do group housing are doing. But it's actually been shown that group housing is very beneficial, both for the animals and the likelihood of them leaving the shelter. Because immediately, say somebody that comes in that has their own cat, now they're immediately at ease that this cat is okay with other cats, right? So that's one plus. To answer your question about how to implement it, I think you make the assessment of, clearly if you have the cat that, you know, the ears are up and it's not quote unquote smiling, no, we're not introducing that guy. But for, you know, a cat that is interactive, likes other humans, you might even notice is a little bit curious about another cat that's meowing, then for sure.
Put them in there and hope it goes well.
Yep.
No, not so much hope.
What I've observed, and even like in the vet clinic that I worked at, we did some boarding of cats, and for those people that went away for, let's say, 3 weeks or what have you, I mean, it's not ideal to leave them under the circumstances, but sometimes people don't have a choice. We would allow one of the cats in one of the exam rooms, and then if another cat was super friendly, obviously, in our case, it's different. We have to ask the owner's permission, but you guys don't have to do that. You need to be present. You need to also think about, okay, what happens if one of them, and cats generally don't all of a sudden attack one another, right? You will, cats, unlike dogs, give you warning signs. They, you know, there's something called the piloerector muscle,
It's the same thing that, you know, cats, you know, leave their fur all over you because they're nervous under the circumstances. It's the same thing that puffs a cat's fur up, so you're looking for that. You're looking for the right noise kind of thing. What's their body posture? The same kinds of things that you look for in the cage, you're looking for when they're interacting.
So how did you monitor like their food intake and their...
So that's the most common thing, right? So again, not that the person has to be there 10 out of 12 hours, but you can't really tell on a one-off. But if the cats are in there together, right, after a couple of days, you're going to be able to tell, okay, did I see that cat go to the litter box? Did I see that cat go to a food bowl? Did I see that cat walk around and be interactive, not just with me, but with the other cats? So it's not going to be 3, 4, 5 days before you pick up that the cat's not eating it, right? You're going to be able, and no, you can't measure exact in and outs, but you're going to get a sense of, is that cat doing well? And just to be clear, group housing normally takes place for a period of time out of the day. And then once the shelters that I've seen do this are convinced that that cat is thriving, then maybe some of those cats will stay together, but they never stay together at night, right, kind of thing.
So that's what I was kind of thinking, because you guys have a few different separate rooms, and often you let out one cat at a time, right, let them roam around the room. So maybe this is opportunity where maybe two cats can be out together, and you can monitor to see if those two would get along, and then ultimately they'd go back in their cages where their food and water is, so you can maintain that aspect of it. And then maybe you switch, and another two different cats come out, so it gives them the opportunity for that interaction. I don't know if that makes sense.
Perfect. You had a question, sorry.
No, it was already brought up.
Okay.
My concern would also be, somebody vomited. Like, you don't know who's got the diarrhea, and that can be a problem when you have kittens together, and
for
then
sure.
You have to separate everybody to find out who's doing what.
So, again, even in general practice, oftentimes people will, you know, adopt two or three cats or kittens rather at the same time. And so, a couple of things. One is, for a cat to have vomiting every now and again, no big deal, not dangerous, right? But if a cat's vomiting, you will see that cat vomit at some point in time, because they're not just going to vomit once or twice a day. They're going to keep vomiting because something's bothering their digestive system. So I'm not saying be flippant about vomiting, right? But you will catch them. So for instance, by analogy, one of the things that people will talk to us about, which is very dangerous and very scary for people to see, is seizuring in cats. And then once we get them onto a medication to adjust that, you know, they're coming in on their annual checkup, and we'll check in and say, have there been any seizures? And invariably people will say, no, I haven't seen one, but I don't know what's happening when I'm at work, right? Fair enough, but the likelihood of it only happening when you're at work versus a couple of times when you're at home is virtually zero. And so if it's happening that often, by analogy vomiting, you're going to see it happen at some point in time. So, and vomiting in and of itself is normally accompanied by things like off their food, lethargic. Maybe not like, you know, the morning that it starts, but within 24 hours, it's the same thing for most pet owners, right? Sometimes a person's at work all day long, they don't observe their cat vomit until they get home and see the spots around in the car on the carpet, and then I'll say to them, how many times did you see the vomiting in the last 24 hours? Some people will answer 6 times, but in actual fact, it might have only been once, but in 6 different places. They can't tell me that with certainty. It doesn't really change what I'm going to do as a veterinarian. It's not going to change what our approach is towards that individual. If we find vomit, well, we're going to be all that more vigilant to see, does this happen in the next 12 to 24 hours? If it does, whose is it, right? So, again, not to be flippant, But if there's a pattern, one of the beautiful things about cats and dogs is they're creatures of habit, right? So if they're going to do something, if there's something problematic, it's not just going to happen as a one-off. We're going to have the opportunity to catch it. And again, with group housing, I still think that it's important to have a check-in on those animals once every hour, once every couple of hours. It doesn't have to be on a schedule. But once we get, in my experience with the group housing that I've seen, you know, there are open windows, people are walking by, they're seeing what's happening.
You have a couple of folks back in this back row here who's joined from the Hamilton Burlington SPCA, and they do group housing for their cats as well. So maybe pick their brains on how they integrate and how they do things as well.
We
find too, though, that a lot of our cats in Hamilton are dealing with hoarders. So these cats have never moved to home.
They have trouble being in a cage by themselves.
Even sometimes when we take them up for surgery, if we're taking 10 from one hoard, we'll just make sure we put a black tom with a buff tom. And they'll spend almost that whole day in the hospital together because they're not used to being alone.
That's awesome.
And then giving them a hidey even when they go up for surgery. They get a brown paper bag that they can hide it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That's great. There you go.
I wanted to ask, I'm from South Africa, so
I had no idea.
Cats are me, it's very new working with cats.
Yeah.
Cats are out of the road, they're not indoors, they are hunting and doing whatever. So I often have to help with the pickup student events and that. So for me, I mean everybody else might know, but what is the most comfortable place in the vehicle to put a cat? I often put them in the front next to me and put the seatbelt around them, because I took them to the back, they were screaming and going crazy, but car ride is so stressful for cats, because my dogs love it, and you put a cat in, they go insane. So what can we do to make that better?
So the short answer is not a whole heck of a lot. I think covering the cage with either a towel or a blanket, because to the best of my knowledge, there's no study, but having had my own cats where I've had to bring them, I remember actually my first cat was a guy named Felix, who was an orange tabby, who was super, super affectionate, very interactive with people, wonderful guy. My folks lived in Montreal at the time. We had young kids, and so we were going back and forth, you know, to go visit. He would lose his mind. To the point where, you know, one of us would keep our hand inside his carrier most of the ride. But I believe that because cats have such an adept perception of, you know, being able to jump and walk along a window ledge, I'm reminded when I worked on a dairy farm before I got into vet school, there was a blind cat that had an entire litter on the windowsill. And she would walk in and amongst the cows on the feeding table, even though she was blind. So I think a car blows a cat's mind. They're just not meant to move that quickly. They're not the ones moving. They're not the ones controlling the situation. So I think for many of them, it's just a horrible feeling. Like it really puts them in an uncomfortable position. So if we cover, they're great. The movement and the there's something called the chemo receptor trigger zone inside the brain that has a lot to do with nausea. Again, hasn't been studied to the best of my knowledge, but I think that rapid movement without them causing the movement is something that really disturbs them. So I think, keeping them close by so that, you know, maybe they can hear our voice, that kind of thing, and definitely covering the crate is really important.
I just want to add to that too. So Dr. Liz O'Brien has an initiative with five other veterinarians as well on cats. And they have a website called cathealthy.ca. And there's some really fantastic tips on there. It's really an initiative to help bring awareness to cat health, really, and making sure people are bringing their cats to the veterinarians. making sure you know your cat is in a in an unstressful environment. I actually left some posters for Doug that you can hang up around here, and it helps to talk about environmental enrichment and the things that you can do to enrich your cat's life to help to reduce that stress. And some of those things you can talk about with your doctors or even adopt here in the shelter. But cathealthy.ca, it's a really great resource, and there's actually a whole section on how to take your cat to the veterinarian or how to make a better experience right from the steps to the car. And at some point we did have postcards. Actually, Karen was reminding me. These guys actually did a pilot with Hamilton Burlington SPCA and Cat Healthy, working together on ensuring that there was a veterinarian in place and cats were getting their proper vaccinations. And it was actually very successful, really successful program. So there's lots of great information on that website. I'll make sure I include this in all the follow-up. But you can go on the website yourself and have a look at some different objectives they have on there.
Thank you.
Dr. O'Brien, who many of you probably heard of, she's actually speaking this coming Sunday at the Lancaster Cat Show. She's amazing. But the other thing,
and you'll be speaking as yes, well too. You're also amazing.
The indoor it's called the Indoor Cat Initiative, and it's through I believe the Ohio State Veterinary College. And they have some great stuff that way also. Anybody else? Awesome. Make sure you partake in some treats.
Yeah.
Well, on behalf of Burlington Humane, thank you so much, Dr. Grover, for joining us.
Questions that you didn't think of today, maybe it's tomorrow, or maybe when you start to implement something new, for an email away.
You said you know the exit.
Yeah, I love the exit.
Thank you.
And it's now like it's been relatively recent in Ontario. It's been built. Yeah, that would be a major
question. Question I had, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, you're trying to educate people to come in on this. Once not a problem,
sure.
But a lot of people are not.
Yeah.
Know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's. I mean, I can tell you when I first started practicing 25 years ago, even up to maybe 15 years ago, we'd have like a few a week, and then over the course of the last 5 years, it's become an easy thing to not do anymore because almost nobody does.
I also have a box of dog toys.
Oh.
Some are barely used. Some are not even used. My dog's a bit spoiled. I have it in the cart. Can I put it by the cart in the
yeah,
cart?
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And if you guys
this door is open.
Okay.
Right here. I mean, you just think, yeah.
All right. It's a big box. So I'll probably just put it in my cart.
Great. Thank you.